Good morning, I'm Sam Fuqua. Coming up, Boulder is about to pick a new city manager. We'll have that news and other local headlines just ahead. And then we'll talk with a CU professor about vaccination priorities and what his mathematical modeling shows about reducing deaths from COVID-19. Our regular Tuesday morning check of the KGNU comment line, where listeners respond to what they hear on KGNU, BBC headlines at 8:30. How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show right after that. Today we hear about the use of the ketogenic diet in protecting against neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's. The Wit and the Wisdom of Alan Watts at 9, then eclectic music on the Morning Sound Alternative at 9:30. All still coming up and all made possible by the listener members of KGNU. Thanks to everybody who contributed during our spring fun drive last week, and folks who contribute year-round. You really do make everything possible here at listener-supported community radio. Thank you. Checking state and local news, a hiring committee is expected to recommend to Boulder City Council tonight that the deputy manager of Austin, Texas, be hired as Boulder's next city manager. KGNU's Roz Brown has more.
After holding virtual meetings for the public to meet two finalists in February, a Boulder City Council subcommittee is expected to recommend Austin's deputy city manager for the job as Boulder city manager at a meeting tonight. Nuria Rivera-Vandermeed would replace Jane Brodigam, who served for 12 years as Boulder city manager before retiring last October. In last month's presentation, Rivera-Vandermeed said in Austin, since 2019, she'd worked on homelessness, public safety reform, and lifting up the work of city government to get closer to the community.
I come to government and public service genuinely. I'm an attorney by profession and came to really realize a love for public service in an unlikely place in corrections in Puerto Rico, which is where I'm from originally, and really discovered there the power of organizational change that kind of stuck with me and really made me think about government in a different way and how close we are to really improving quality of life for those that we serve.
Boulder City Council, which has the responsibility to make the decision by charter, is expected to vote on the hiring committee's recommendation as well as review proposed contract details tonight. Rivera-Vandermeed told the public meeting she was familiar with Boulder and eager to serve.
And I will confess that while I was not looking to leave Austin, Boulder, on a personal level, was a city that my husband and I visited once and fell in love and continued to say and visit and think that this is a place that we would love to live if we got an opportunity that fit our world. And this opportunity came sooner than I anticipated, but I am excited to be considered. I am excited to lend my voice to this community and my experience. And I hope as we get to talk to each other that we'll learn more about what the needs and what the expectations and what the desires of community for and the vision of community for Boulder is.
Councilmember Mary Young, who sat on the hiring committee, said Rivera-Vandermeed's values, authenticity, poise, curiosity, experience, and collaborative data-driven approach to problem solving could lead Boulder through the transformational change needed to meet challenges and aspirations. Under the proposed contract, Rivera-Vandermeed would earn $290,000 a year as city manager and start on May 10, 2021. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
Despite a drop in enrollment, Colorado schools will still receive full funding for the current school year under a law signed Monday by Governor Jared Polis. For the 2020 to 2021 school year, the number of students is down 3.3%. That's about 30,000 fewer students statewide. The drop is attributed to parents pulling their kids out due to the pandemic. State funding to public school districts is based on the number of students, but state lawmakers did not want to send less funding when districts were already struggling to respond to the challenges of COVID-19. The bill signed into law Monday maintains full funding for districts and also includes extra money for districts that saw a significant increase in students living in poverty. Representative Julie McCluskey, a Democrat from Dillon, is one of the bill's sponsors. She says the pandemic heightens the need to reevaluate how we fund schools in Colorado.
Now is the time to figure out how we can drive more dollars to our communities of poverty, our small, rural, remote communities, the communities that are most adversely impacted by this moment.
The state continues to hold back some money intended for public schools to pay for other budget priorities. New studies of students at CU Boulder show that many of the people infected with COVID-19 may not be contagious. Steve Miller reports.
The first study found that about half of COVID-19 infected people may not spread the virus, but you won't be able to judge who is doing the transmitting just looking at the symptoms. Researchers looked at weekly COVID-19 tests that were given to 1,400 CU Boulder students living in dormitories and who tested positive but weren't showing symptoms, compared with people who'd been hospitalized with the virus. For Professor Sarah Sawyer, the senior author of the study, this means that some asymptomatic people are carrying a viral load as high as someone who is on a ventilator in a hospital bed. A second study using the same data found that students with higher amounts of the virus in their saliva were more likely to have infected their roommates. Just 20% of students who tested positive had passed it on to a roommate. These results could let universities tell if they can continue offering on-campus housing with roommates. Professor Sawyer said that both studies show that most people with COVID didn't get other people sick, but a few people got a lot of people sick. Both studies have yet to be reviewed for potential mistakes or omissions. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Colorado's unemployment rate dropped a little bit in January. The State Department of Labor and Employment says the rate fell from 6.9% in December to 6.6%. BizWest reports that most of the jobs that were added since the start of the new year are in the hospitality industry, as Colorado has relaxed some of the COVID restrictions to allow for more in-person activities. More hospitality businesses are hiring back workers after mass layoffs last year. But the actual unemployment rate is typically higher than the reported rate because some adults have dropped out of the workforce and aren't included in the reported data. Schools are closed today and all activities canceled in the Boulder Valley School District. St. Vrain schools are operating under an inclement weather online learning day, meaning buildings are closed, but classes are still happening online. Denver Public Schools are also online only today. Again, no school today in the BVSD, but online school is happening in St. Vrain in Denver and most other metro area districts. Light snow is possible today. Cloudy skies, highs in the upper 30s. Overnight lows tonight will be in the 20s, and for Wednesday, partly cloudy with a forecast of 40 degrees. It's 14 minutes after 8. This is KGNU. As Colorado and the U.S. roll out a wider vaccination program, the work of one University of Colorado mathematician is helping set the priorities for who gets vaccinated when. Daniel Larimore is a computational biologist who used mathematical modeling to examine vaccine distribution strategies. He published information on his modeling recently in the journal Science. And we asked him what the modeling shows about vaccinating older adults ahead of some frontline workers.
The frustration of vaccine prioritization is that when we prioritize one group, we have to deprioritize another group. And so choosing what order people are going to go in means that some people have to go first and other people have to go second. But the big question with our modeling was, how can we save the most lives possible? And in that calculation, we need to take into account that, yes, some people are going to be more likely to be exposed to the virus than others. But we also need to take into account that some people are more likely to die if they get infected than others. And in the balance of all those things and doing all the modeling, inclusive of the fact that viral spread was essentially uncontrolled in the U.S. During December, January, and early February, our conclusions in the study were that those older adults really should be prioritized first, to minimize mortality, followed by people who are more high contact and more likely to be exposed or transmit to others.
Can you give us a layperson's explanation of what you were modeling, how you did that?
I mean, by now in the pandemic, a lot of folks are maybe familiar with some of these simulation models where we can consider a population of people who are susceptible to the virus and some people who are recovered from the virus. And the whole time the infection is circulating in a simulation. And then we can ask, what would be the effect of vaccinating some people in the population first versus vaccinating another group in the population first? And we can run the simulations forward in both of those scenarios to try to determine in which scenario do we consistently see lower mortality than in which other scenarios. So in addition to looking at vaccinating older adults first or vaccinating high contact adults first, we also looked at other ideas like, what if we vaccinated all the children first? Or what if we gave the vaccine out without any prioritization at all? And it turns out that the two leading candidates in the simulations were vaccinating older adults in first place, and then vaccinating those high contact adults aged 20 to 50 in second place.
As we enter this wider rollout period in the U.S. and many other parts of the world are far behind, what will you be watching for in your modeling going forward?
So the things that we should be looking for as vaccines continue to roll out in the U.S. are that hospitalizations and mortality should really start to take a nosedive over the next month or so. That's as those last vulnerable adults in the older age group, as well as those people with some pre-existing conditions, start to get access to the vaccine, and we start to get really high coverage rates there. So as the vulnerable population really drops because they're vaccinated, we should see hospitalizations and mortality also really drop towards zero. So that's what I'm gonna be looking at in the US, but it's important to remember that we live in a large and interconnected world. And while we're incredibly lucky here in the US and talking about whether or not the prioritization of our subpopulations is fair or unfair, it's important to remember that the rest of the world still doesn't have access to the vaccines at nearly the supply that we have here in a rich country like the US. And so if you're interested in international travel, if you're interested in understanding where some of these new variants are coming from because there's continued circulation, it's important that we realize that there's a whole globe out there that needs these vaccines next. So my next focus is gonna be turned toward that global picture and how can we think about prioritization as well as sort of getting the most bang for the buck in terms of every single dose outside of the US as well.
So you alluded to this, what if the current identified variants take greater hold or other variants as the virus continues to mutate? Current vaccines are less effective. New, more effective ones aren't yet available. Did you model a scenario like that? And if so, same conclusions?
Yeah, in the paper, we were curious about what would be the impact of those different prioritization strategies. But we were curious about that long before we had any clinical trial data. And so we were starting to look at this question as early as last spring of 2020. And so what we did in simulations, because we can control things in the parameter settings, we looked at different values for that key number, vaccine efficacy. How well does the vaccine prevent against disease? And what we found was that regardless of the vaccine efficacy, it still made sense to prioritize those vulnerable older adults in the US. However, if we're out of the prioritization phase and now we're thinking about just in general, what if the vaccine efficacy against a variant is lower? Like instead of 95%, maybe it's 85% or even 70%. It's critical to realize that even a 70% efficacy vaccine is a fantastic vaccine in terms of its population effects for reducing transmission and in terms of its individual protective effects. Because even though a 70% effective vaccine sounds like it's going to get a grade of C, you know, 70%, in fact, that vaccine is also going to likely make any infection that you do get less severe. So, you know, I would say that while we should be worried about some of these variants, we shouldn't be too worried. The vaccines actually look like they're going to do pretty well in spite of the circulating variants.
So there's no scenario, or is there, where it would make sense to, say, prioritize vaccinating frontline workers or younger adults over older people?
At this point, I think that we should really stay the course, given that we are about to be entering a phase, at least in Colorado here in the next week or so, where we really are rolling out the vaccine to all of those frontline workers and so on, who have maybe not yet had access. But that group will still have access before the general public. So I think right now we're on a great course. And I think sticking with the current plan, you know, for the next week until those essential frontline workers can get the vaccine is the right way to go.
And finally, you said at the start of our conversation, you're modeling all other things being equal. All other things aren't equal, of course. And we've on KGNU and other places talked a lot about inequities in the distribution of the vaccine by income, by racial demographic, et cetera. Do you have any comment on that aspect of this problem?
Yeah, I it's important for folks to understand that in our particular study, we were only thinking about vaccine prioritization by age. And so we weren't able to take into account all of those other aspects related to equity. And one of the reasons why is that while we have great information on the contact rates of people of different age groups with other folks of other age groups, we don't have those same contact patterns and the same level of data granularity when it comes to these other important attributes. One reason here is that in the US, we value our privacy and our data privacy so much that when it comes to parameterizing models, we just don't have the measurements in order to make some good estimates. But I completely agree with you. I think that the big stories of this pandemic really revolve around equity and access to care, and that includes access to vaccines.
Anything you'd like to add?
When it's your turn, please go get vaccinated.
Daniel Larimar is a computational biologist at the BioFrontiers Institute, which is part of the University of Colorado Boulder. He uses mathematical modeling to, among other things, examine vaccine distribution strategies. It's 23 minutes after 8. This is listener-supported KGNU.
Support comes from Centennial Peaks Hospital, offering help for listeners or their loved ones who may be experiencing a mental health crisis. Inpatient and outpatient services available from a medical staff of independent practitioners. ECT available for treatment-resistant conditions. Details at centennialpeaks.com.
Up next on The Morning Magazine, time for the KGNU comment line, where listeners tell us what they like and don't like about what they're hearing on community radio.
Hi, this is Marty, and I continue to find it discouraging that the majority of KGNU's COVID coverage is the same information that we hear on corporate media, with no offering of alternative scientific viewpoints. Of course, the current push is for everyone to get vaccinated as quickly as possible. I'm 70 years old and have decided not to get the vaccine for the following reasons. As we all know, this vaccine was developed at warp speed. All prior vaccine development and safety testing have taken years. The words warp speed and science don't usually go well together. The Moderna, Pfizer, and now Johnson & Johnson vaccines have not been approved by the FDA. They were granted emergency use authorization and, as such, are considered experimental. Those choosing to get the vaccine are, in actuality, participants in the largest clinical trial of a vaccine ever conducted. The Moderna and Pfizer vaccines employ messenger RNA, a genetic technology never before used in humans. Trials were inadequate to assess the risks in older populations since the majority of trial participants were 18 to 64 years old. Yet, older adults are the ones highest on the priority list to receive this experimental vaccine. In addition, clinical trials included healthy individuals, so we don't have data on how the vaccine will affect those with existing medical conditions, people with compromised immune systems, pregnant women, or those taking medications. By definition, there's no long-term data on the effects of these vaccines. Why is this important? long-term vaccine safety research includes animal studies, but these are bypassed. Following the emergence of SARS in 2002, there was a great deal of research on developing a coronavirus vaccine. Initially, the animal studies looked promising, with the animals developing antibodies in response to the vaccine. However, they later developed a severe hyperimmune response, causing illness and death in the animals when they were exposed to the actual virus. As of February 18th, almost a month ago, close to 20,000 adverse events were reported to our government's Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, or VAERS. This included over 1,000 deaths. All viruses mutate, as we are already seeing with SARS-CoV-2. Will the current vaccine be effective on those, or will we need a new vaccine for every variant that emerges? And if yes, then how many vaccines will we need each year to keep up? And how long will the current vaccines be effective? We don't know, as there's no data. Will they last 3 months, 6 months? How does this help us continue to be safe and get back to our normal lives? If you live in Colorado, the chances of surviving this pandemic are 99.8%. That's 5% higher than the efficacy rate of both Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, and 33% higher than the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, without having to take the risk of injecting an experimental vaccine. So, who has true immunity? Turns out it's Big Pharma. The Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 and the PREP Act of 2020 eliminated financial liability for vaccine manufacturers from any injury or death claims. That means you have no financial recourse from these companies, but more importantly, manufacturers are incentivized to sidestep years of safety testing and rush their products to a multi-billion dollar market since they bear no liability. My wish is for everyone to stay healthy. If you haven't yet gotten the vaccine, I encourage you to look beyond the words safe and effective that we hear repeated on the media and make an informed decision based on your own research. Thank you.
Hi, I just want to say I just started reading The Alchemy of Us that I heard about on your Tuesday morning science show, which I always listen to later on your archives. I appreciate the show. I appreciate the author, and I've always felt I'm a material scientist, being a geologist that gets me very, very close to being into the material.
Thanks for those calls to the KGNU comment line. You can call at any time, 303-447-9911, 303-447-9911. It's voicemail. Leave your comment. We play them back over the air Tuesday mornings here on The Morning Magazine. How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, coming your way in just a couple minutes.